for this April 15th, the penultimate day we can work on House bills.
Love that.
Unfortunately, we are not ready to work on several of them that I would be happy to work on today. So if you're here, let me give you the list of bills we are not going to work today. We are not going to work 2118, 2132, 2122, 3403, 2928, 3345, although we will have a public hearing on 3345 later, but we won't do a work session on it. We're carrying over 3082 and 2085, although we may open up a public hearing on 2085. Those are all to be carried over, and we'll see what happens to the rest of them. 2118, 2132, 2122, 3403, 2928, 3345, 3082, and 2085. That means we better plan on keeping the 5 o'clock hour on Wednesday, because we're running down to the deadline, and if we get any glitches, we may need to come back at 5 to clean them up. So I would hope we can finish it all before 5 o'clock on Wednesday, but if we can't...
Just looking forward to that.
5 o'clock.
3.
Yeah, right. 5 o'clock again. I'm going to open up a... Which one is that? 2960? I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2916. I'm going to call the chair to testify and Representative Freeman to repute it.
Please discuss the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2960 requires a portion of each meeting of the governing body of a coordinated care organization be dedicated to taking public comment and announcing and explaining significant decisions made by the governing body. It requires community advisory council meet at least once every 3 months and that meetings be open to the public.
Is there a chair here?
Oh, Chair Thompson.
Hello.
Evidently.
Have the administrator do it. That was going to be interesting.
Which bill are we on now?
We'll screw up at a chain of command there.
Tyler had it.
He already opened it. He just doesn't want to talk yet.
Chair Greenlake.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlake, House District 33. In Northwest Portland, out to far Washington County, and I'm really happy to have the opportunity to talk to you about, particularly about the Dash 3 amendments of House Bill 2960. This bill, in its original form, had a companion bill in the Senate, and both of those bills essentially required that the CCO board meetings and other meetings be subject to the public meeting laws. This caused a great deal of consternation among the CCOs, and that caused us, after talking to several, to modify the concept in the form of the Dash 3 amendments. The basic concept was that the CCOs operate under, in many instances, under an antitrust shelter. They operate with, in many places, monopoly situations in the healthcare field for the dealing with the Oregon Health Plan members, that they have access to hundreds of millions of dollars of public funds, and therefore their meetings ought to be open to the public. The contrary opinion was strongly expressed by several CCOs, and for this bill, we decided to modify it so that two things happen. The meetings of the citizens advisory boards, which are advisory to the community, be open meetings, and that there be a portion of each CCO board meeting that's open to the public for the purpose of allowing the board to explain decisions they've made, to announce decisions they may explain them, and in some instances take public testimony. Basically, that's all this bill does. So I'm available to answer any questions or share the podium with my colleague and friend, Representative Freeman.
Sherry Freeman, do you like to testify? And then we'll open for questions again for both of you.
Great, thank you. Thank you, Vice Chair Thompson and the rest of the great health care committee. I almost forgot how exciting health care policy work was until I walked in the room and saw it was full. So there must be all kinds of great stuff going on.
Or but weird stuff.
That's your definition. I'm trying to for the record, my name's Tim Freeman, State Representative for House District 2, and one of the short straw drawers of the architect of CCO development. I wanted to share a little bit of historical perspective and talk about a couple of the principles of coordinated care organizations as I saw them as we went through the bill work last time. And probably the most important principle that we worked on was flexibility. The idea of having communities around our state come together and be innovative and try to find solutions that we were admitting as a legislature that we weren't going to get right for every community equal. So we said, let's let this flexibility work. Let's let different communities find what works for them. So currently, there's nothing that keeps a CCO from having all their meetings public if that's what they choose to do and that's what works best for their community. So again, this bill, and I do appreciate the good chair's amendment trying to sort of bring it down a little bit, but really it's unnecessary. The fact is, communities that choose to have open meetings and have everybody there and go through the process that's pretty vital to get the people in their community bought in on this delivery system will do that. Other communities may do it in a different way. They may choose to have a portion of their meetings that are just the board where they can get down to business and get the innovation and the work done, and they may choose to have an entire meeting that's open for the public where they can share what they're doing with the public. So it's being done in a bunch of different ways. My fear on this amendment and this bill is that now we're going to go back to you shall. You are going to do this. And I want you all to remember in Portland, we got people competing to do this work. And most of the rest of the state, we are begging people to do this work. It's very difficult to get providers in some parts of our state because the money's not very good, and at times trying to move into a new delivery system and coordinate care in a different way is difficult. So it's one of those things where just because in one part of the state you got a great competition and they want to make this all, you know, open and public and we're going to do it all this way, doesn't mean it's going to work well everywhere else. And keep in mind, whatever we pass here will become law and will affect all the coordinated care organizations around the state. So really, as back to the principle of the bill, we really tried to develop legislation that would allow for that innovation and sort of that community solution to come forward. And I believe it's starting to work. I believe we're very early in the process of coordinated care and these groups working together. I know a lot of these folks are at the table with each other for the first time, and they're building trust and relationships. And as we move forward, I think it'll be a very healthy thing for delivering the Medicaid program in our communities. I would caution you all in changing it so soon. We're just getting started. There could be an opportunity in the future where if we see examples where it's not working or something needs to be changed, we'll be back here every year after year, to do whatever we need to do. But I don't believe right now is the right time, and I would urge you just to let the coordinated care organizations develop to figure out what works best for their community and let them work for a while. And it seems to me like there's lots of other stuff we could be working on.
Mr. Chair, if I can make a brief comment.
Please.
I've been watching the development. I was involved with the other part of the short straw with Representative Freeman as we talked with the development of House Bill 3650 and some following activities. there is clearly a stress between, in some cases, between the community members and the board of the CCO. I heard strong but quiet support from members of the Citizen Advisory Committee members in the north of the state, the central part of the state, and the southern part of the state, where there was still some tension between their role and the role of the board. They universally thought having their meetings open would be an important piece, and they also felt very strongly that some part of the board meeting should be available so they can have access to what's going on to some extent. And this doesn't define, this is about a process. It doesn't define what needs to be open. It doesn't define how much of the board needs to be open. It simply says some portion of a board meeting ought to be open to the public so that the public can talk to the board and the board can talk to the public. The CACs typically have one member of their Citizen Advisory Council on the board, and that member is bound by confidentiality arrangements in the board. So that person can't even come back to their own committee and talk about what's happening in the board because they feel constrained by what their requirements are as a board member as well as a Citizen Advisory Committee. This is about process. It's not about content. It helps to assure that the input from the community, which is what the argument needs to be in each special community, can have some possibility of being heard. So it's in that sense, I think, a very modest impact on the organizations. I don't see how it can harm the organizations in any way to have at least lip service to public input from their community.
Just real briefly, and I know.
Please.
Thank you. And I agree with the good chair that it's important that the people that are receiving these services and the community at large is part of the delivery model. we've made sure the Coordinated Care Organization Board was going to be one of the members required by statute to be from the Citizen Advisory Committee, and we gave statutory authority for certain segments of the policy to be done by the Citizen Advisory Council. So it's not lip service by any means. It's really meant to be part of the solution, and I'm not going to go into all the great things the Citizen Advisory Committee should be working on, and I know they are. But what I would like to tell you all is there's nothing in the current statute that keeps from happening what Representative Greenlight just described. So those communities that want to do that and figure that's the best way to get to their community and involve them, they certainly can. Again, other communities that want to have a quarterly public meeting that's well attended or some other mechanism to address communicating with their people in their community, they can choose that way. This amendment and this bill, again, makes it prescriptive that everybody's going to do it the same. That's exactly opposite of what one of the principles that I worked under of the flexibility. So that, again, I like the idea of having the citizens involved. The people that are getting the care need to have input on how it's delivered. If we're going to do any kind of innovation or cost savings, they've got to be part of the solution. But let the community figure out how they're going to communicate with their community and what works best for them.
Are there any questions? Yes, please.
Two quick questions. The Citizen Advisory Committee in the original legislation was required to meet at least every 3 months. Is that right?
So this
doesn't
change.
That's
by statute.
And are there any documents that are required by this law? Is it just open for public comment, or is there anything that they have to disclose publicly?
Nothing that they have to disclose.
Okay. No, they actually have to do the community health advisory assessment.
Citizen.
Community health assessment is required to be done by them to present it to the board. So there is a statutory requirement for that, and that, you know, that is something.
And this bill doesn't
do.
Change that.
But not in this amendment.
This not in this amendment. You're right.
Other questions?
So,
yes.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. So, you know, I'm struggling a little bit because my local one is an LLC, and generally speaking, boards of private companies don't get told you're going to have at every meeting of your board something. But I understand these are not just private companies. Mine just happens to be formed in a way that I'm totally familiar with. So I have a hard time getting my mind around an LLC being told what to do with their own board. But having said that, does anything here in these significant decisions or comments or announcing entail essentially like their work product to public records law, or is it just their, you know, it says have a portion of the meeting dedicated to taking public comment. Then it says, and announcing and explaining significant decisions. And I'm interested if then the documents that led to those decisions become public record at that point for this private company.
No, there's nothing in this amendment that makes that happen. And in fact, this simply provides a minimum standard. It doesn't require all CCOs behave the same. If a CCO, for example, wants to have all its meetings open, it can have all its meetings open. But these are LLCs, but they're in a very special circumstance in terms of the ratio. But no, this does not open them to public records any more than they might be open anyway. I suspect that's something that will be tested along the line. But this amendment has nothing to do with that.
Can I make a comment on that?
Please.
And Representative Clem, I understand there's a whole bunch of different structures of business. That's part of the flexibility that's going to allow this to work in different parts of the state and make people feel comfortable coming together and working. And whatever they decide that business organization is right for them is what they'll decide. The challenge is, of course, is when you say you're going to do this and list those things that you just read, which could be interpreted in a different way than what we're assuming them to mean today. So that's where the fear comes. So, again, your LLC will not be successful if they're not communicating with those people that receive this health care. They won't meet the spirit of what we're trying to do with coordinated care if they don't involve the consumers and have those folks be a part of the innovation that's going to help drive down the cost. So they're going to figure out a way to do it. But my suggestion is let's let them figure out the way they want to communicate instead of say, under this special set of circumstances, you've got to say this at every meeting, because not only will it be very guarded and probably not to the degree it needs to be, but it could be subject to people questioning whether they're doing enough or not enough. And really it should be that they want to do it, and I would tell you, for them to be successful in coordinating care and delivering health care in a better way, they're going to have to be doing it anyway. Let's let them figure out which way to do it.
One follow-up, if I might. Sure. My challenge, of course, is if there were a portion of each meeting for the public to take comment, I would go every time and tell one to stop suing the other board member within my LLC.
Yeah, I think you're going to test that freedom of information in your own LLC here.
Maybe he made this one.
It'll be a Kurt document. But the point is, I think they ought to do things differently. All this prescribes is a minimum in terms of their interaction with the community. Have the community advisory meetings open and have some portion of their meeting open. If they want to have town halls that do it, they want to do anything else because they want to get more input from their community. There's nothing here that stops them from doing it. This simply prescribes a pretty bare minimum.
Yes, please.
Have you thought about the implications if protected health information is disclosed in any of these meetings or is discussed, and what how that would play into having the public meeting law?
I'd be happy to amend this on the Senate side to add the CEOs of CCOs.
Oh no! I took us down a rabbit hole.
You can leave now.
Anyone else? Yes, please.
Well, so he raises a question that I just want to make sure I'm clear on. You are asking that a portion of the meeting be made open to the public, but the rest of it can be closed. Is that correct?
And it can be anything. You don't have to declare executive session. They don't have to say what they're doing. You simply say from 8:30 to 9, our meeting will be open tonight.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
May I just comment
yes,
on
please.
That? The two CCOs, and I can't remember, Mr. Chair, if you and I have talked about this or not, but the two CCOs that I am familiar with, because they're relatively local to where I live, both of them have all of their meetings open to the public, it just is a matter of policy. And that has been, I think, an absolute benefit to the operation of the CCO and the perception of what's going on in the communities. However, with that said, there's with the public meeting laws, there comes a lot of obligation for notice. There's a risk that you miss the notice requirements and you can't act. And as a result of all of those problems and costs that would be added to those CCOs, they elected not to subject themselves to public meeting laws. And there was a discussion initially about whether to do that because both of them have county commissioners and others from the public sector on the boards of those CCOs. And so they're very sensitive to public meeting law. And initially they were actually intending, I think, to subject the CCOs to, or the boards, to public meeting laws. They elected not to, not out of a desire to keep anything secret, but out of a desire to be able to move quickly, save as much money as they could, and reduce the complexity of an already incredibly complex task that they have, which is to expend their global budget and transform healthcare in their community.
I've been told there's nothing in here that requires them to conform to public meeting laws. There's no mention of public meeting laws. There's no indication that this links to public meeting law.
So you don't think requiring them to make their meetings public would have that effect?
Meaning one, require them to have one portion of their meeting public? No.
And may I ask one
follow-up
question?
Yes.
If they had a desire to do something like a strategic planning session or something, what would they do under this?
This doesn't stop them from holding any meetings at any time, close with any topic. It just requires them, when they hold a board meeting, to have one portion of it open to the public.
So they would have to have part of their strategic planning session open to the public?
If it was a regular board meeting, they would. They're not subject to public meeting law, so, I mean, conceivably you have subcommittee of the whole, you could have a variety of things where you were doing other business. But their regular board meetings would have to have one portion open to the public. That's all it requires.
Okay. Well,
Representative Clem.
Confusing.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. I was just looking because it looks like that was amended out because the original looks like it was public meeting laws and it was amended out in the dash three amendments.
Yeah.
So this they're not subject to.
Explicitly.
So tell me just a little bit more about the, not the taking public comment part, I get that. It's the announcing and explaining significant decisions made at each, meeting. What's that?
Doesn't say necessarily decisions made at that board meeting, I think. It's just
so decisions just in, made. Maybe in the in-between time. And is that got any meaning in law right now, what an significant decision is?
No.
Okay.
Be up to them.
Representative Freeman.
Great, thank you. And I do appreciate the complexity of the discussion you're having. And I would like to inform the committee we had hours of this discussion as we tried to craft this bill, because we are going into a new area where there is not definitions of a lot of things we're trying to do. And I think that's exactly the fear a lot of CCOs have, is where this amendment and other things we're looking at are new terms without definition. So in order to figure all that out at the same time they're trying to start to work together and coordinate care and deliver a product that our governor promised we would do and took money with that promise, I'm just afraid having a whole new set of hoops and laws and rules, whether it's this or other things we're talking about, will just be that tipping point where folks say, hey, that's enough.
This is one of my concerns. We have CCOs in various levels of formation, one or more of which may still be back in the throwing chairs at their meeting stage.
Pursuing.
I'm not sure that they're all ready, all of them are ready to proceed in an organized fashion on the way their meetings necessarily progress. Though this amendment takes a lot of the sting out of it. What would be the downside in delaying this until February to bring everybody up to a higher plane? And obviously they all know it's coming. Is that time element a problem for anybody? I mean,
well, it's our time limit's a problem.
Yeah.
So this gets over to the Senate, it can be changed. It seems so easy. I mean, that's the...
That's the problem. It seems so easy.
I think it is easy.
No, there's other people that want to testify, yeah. So... Thank you.
Okay. Somebody else in this one? Not good. Mr. Administrator, will you call a couple of more witnesses, please?
Dr. Bob Tannenhofer, Diddy Farr, Dana Sterringer.
Please, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Representative.
We have such a long agenda today, I'm trying to keep it moving.
Thank you, Representative Greenlee and members of the committee. My name is Bob Tannenhofer. I'm the chair of the Umpqua Health Alliance board. That's the CECO that serves Douglas County. We're well past throwing chairs, and I think we're well on the way to transforming care. I think this bill is, I would speak in opposition to this bill. Now, our board, our Health Alliance, has a board that has seven medical leaders from the community, County Commissioner Mr. Paul Morgan, who's the chair of our Community Advisory Council. These issues between the Community Advisory Council and the board really don't seem to exist in Douglas County. Now, I will tell you, we have a very active Community Advisory Board Council. They're there to advise the board. And when we selected the CAC last summer, we strictly followed the statute that you adopted just last year. I'm really proud of this group. They represent consumers. They represent advocates. They're from all parts of the county. Now, as we tried to recruit members for the CAC, several actually asked if they would be publicly named or they need to be at public meetings. There was one local businesswoman whose children were on OHP. She would have been an ideal person, but she didn't want to be identified as someone whose children were on OHP because she didn't want to indirectly have to identify her financial status. One was a victim of domestic violence. She knew if the meetings were public and the minutes were public that she would leave an internet trail, and she was very hesitant to do so. Others were just private people who said, look, we're willing to help, we're willing to give you all kinds of advice, but I really don't want to be getting cards and letters from advocates advocating one thing or another. There was no rule at the time, so we asked OHA, and they agreed there was no rule about whether they would be made public. And so we didn't initially make them public. And then when the group met, we asked for their advice, and they advised us not to release their names. Now, if there's a committee advisory committee that there to give us advice, they give us advice not to release their names, I'm a bit hesitant to do so. So if we're forced to have public meetings, make their names public, not only would I have to go back on my word and reject their advice, but several may actually choose to leave the CAC.
You don't even publicly announce who's a member of the CAC?
We have bios of everybody except for their names. So we tell where they're from, what they put in their application, how they describe themselves, but we haven't done their names for exactly the reasons that I said. I mean, if this woman says, look, I don't want people to know I'm a business person here, I don't want people to know I'm so low income that my kids are on OHP. If the lady who is a victim of domestic violence says, look, if you put my name on the web, then I'm going to be able to be tracked. So these were the issues we dealt with as we chose them, and because there was no rule at the time, we chose not to name them. Now, our chair is a public person. His name's on the website, writes an article in the newspaper every month. So he's easily available, but the individual members of our CAC are not available, and they've chosen not to have public meetings. Now, they did advise us on one thing. That we said, well, how's the best way to get information to the public?
And we said, well, we could open our board meetings as suggested here. And they said, well, that's not really good because people are not going to wait around until you have a few minutes at the end part of your meeting. We meet usually at 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning. They thought that was not a particularly good way to do it. We said, what would be the best way to tell people in the community about what's going on at the CCO? They recommended that we have evening meetings in a community center. We serve food, we have child care, and that somebody from the CCO stand there and take questions until there are no more questions. And that's what we do. So on April 4th, we had our meeting in Winston, and in Winston, that's what we did. So I would tell you that we're trying to innovate. This really will take away the innovation that our local community advisory council advises us to do, and it'll stop the innovation in its tracks. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Kenny Geyer, and Thompson, members of the committee. My name is Debbie Farr. I'm here on behalf of Trillium Community Health Plan in Eugene, Oregon. We serve approximately 55,000 Oregon Health Plan members. We're the coordinated care organization in Lane County. And I appreciate Mr. Dannenhofer's comments because clearly CCOs operate differently based on their location in different parts of the state. At Trillium, we have been very transparent. We have excellent two-way communication between Trillium and the public. All of our board minutes are published on the website for the governing board as well as our community advisory councils. We have regular community conversations scheduled. Our next one is April 25th, and it's at a community center in Eugene. The last one, we had about 100 people in attendance, and we were also able to answer all of the questions in the crowd. Additionally, a representative from our community advisory council, and actually Trillium is a little bit different because we not only have a community advisory council that meets in the metro area, we also have a rural advisory council. And those two councils meet monthly. All of their meetings are open to the public. In fact, the first 10 minutes of each of those meetings is dedicated to public comment. We've had many community members there testifying as well as members of the media. A representative from our CAC and RAC attend board meetings. We have a representative from each that are members of the Trillium board, and those representatives report back to their individual councils. Everything's been working well without conflict. Trillium has also worked with local media. We've had several news stories in the Register Guard, as well as television and radio interviews. In fact, recently, we were named in a New York Times article, which I hope all of you read, that highlighted Oregon's health care reform. It was published on Saturday, and in Eugene, Oregon.
I ask you to speed it up?
Yes, you can.
I'm really panicky about 8 more bills.
So Representative Freeman referred to all the wonderful things the community advisory councils are doing, and so I encourage you to read the New York Times article if you haven't yet. But finally, the legislation before you today is unnecessary. It could only serve to undermine our successful efforts. Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing. Thank you very much. And we'll get back to a work session later. I'm going to open a public hearing on, where are we? This is a balance bill. On 3345. Can I ask Representative Hoyle to join us, please? And we will be doing a public hearing on this, but we don't have the documents for a work session, so let's make it somewhat brief.
Val Hoyle, House District 14, West Eugene and Junction City. I will not read to you from these four pieces of paper, but I am here today to talk to you about body parts. And the reason I'm here to talk to you about body parts is that in 2011, we had a bill before the Health Care Committee that was brought forward to regulate for-profit, non-transplant, anatomical recovery organizations that use human body tissues and or cells for non-clinical scientific research or educational purposes. So effectively, there are a group of people, both groups that are involved in tissue transplant and donation, and also the mortuary board and for-profit companies who cover the costs of someone's funeral or cremation, that again provide these body parts for medical or scientific research. But again, there are at least two companies that I know of in the state of Oregon that are these types of companies. And when the bill came up, it needed more work, and the good chair asked me to pull together a stakeholder group to see if we could determine what kind of oversight there could be that would allow for consumer protection, would allow to ensure that the remaining remains of a body are treated with the kind of respect that that someone that is deceased deserves to be treated with, and that medical waste could be treated as medical waste, that there's tracking and oversight. So we've worked really hard on this bill, and we have some Dash 6 and Dash 7 amendments that all the parties have agreed are acceptable. There were two things that were not included that I want to mention on the record. One, in the Dash 7s, we were supposed to include something that said a hospital healthcare facility that performs a post-mortem examination, research, education, or laboratory testing facility would be exempt, and that wasn't put in. We'll have that put in by Wednesday when you get your fiscal. And also, we were going to delete Section 6. That was a drafting error that hasn't been done. So you will have a Draft 8. The fiscal will not change. This is a good bill. A lot of work has gone into it, and I hope that you see fit to pass it. And I'll take any questions you might have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have a couple of witnesses. Is that right? Will you please call the witnesses?
Messina Squires, April Salisbury, and Steve Wells.
Please, quickly.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the House Health Care Committee. For the record, Messina Squires today here on behalf of two of the entities that would be regulated under the provisions of House Bill 3345-67 or 8 amendment. MedCure and BioGift, both companies operate in Gresham, and we have been working with Representative Hoyle on a series of amendments to this piece of legislation that would provide for regulation via the Oregon Health Authority of these two companies. What's being handed out is my testimony in a section-by-section summary of the Dash 6 amendment. It is lengthy. It does set up a program within Oregon Health Authority. We have no objections to the Dash 6 amendments and or the 7 and the forthcoming 8 amendment. And with that, I'd just like to introduce my two clients and let them just give a brief explanation of the work that they do.
Good afternoon, members of the House Healthcare Committee. For the record, my name is April Salisbury, and I am the Chief Executive Officer for MedCure Incorporated. Our company was established in 2005 by David Urbina and Jonas Losnik. MedCure is a non-transplant anatomical tissue bank devoted to compassionate and ethical services that connect the gift of whole-body donors to medical educators and researchers worldwide. Our 74 highly educated and trained employees serve our locations in Cumberland, Rhode Island, Tampa, Florida, Orlando, Florida, Henderson, Nevada, and our newly constructed corporate headquarters in Portland, Oregon. In 2012, MedCure became the first U.S.-based non-transplant anatomical donation organization to establish international roots in order to serve the growing research and education needs abroad. Thank you for this opportunity to appear before you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, members of the House Health Care Committee. For the record, my name is Steve Wells, and I am the operations manager for BioGift. BioGift Anatomical is a non-transplant whole-body anatomical donation company. We launched on January 1st, 2003 in Tigard and relocated to Portland in December 2006. BioGift currently employs 5 individuals. Our purpose is to advance medical sciences through education and research. BioGift provides fresh frozen anatomical specimens to respected academic, government, corporate, and continuing education cadaver training programs. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee would have.
You're okay with the bill in its amended form, is that?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, yes, we're okay with the Dash 6, 7, and we understand what's coming in the 8, and we do not have any objection.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for testifying.
Mr. Chair,
yes?
If I could, a question?
Yes, please.
Are there fees in this bill?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenemer, the Dash 6 amendment did not have fees specified. I received a Dash 7 amendment that immediately before the hearing, and on page 2, line 27, there is a fee for obtaining or renewing a license, and it is $1,700. It's a not to exceed $1,750. So the fee is set in the...
So it's statutory.
It is set in the statutory framework under the Dash 7.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3345 and open up a work session on House Bill 2136. Mr. Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2136 with the DAS 1 amendment requires the Oregon Department of Administrative Services transfer funds from the Tobacco Settlement Funds account to Oregon Opportunity Fund and Oregon Health Science University Bond Administrative Fund before July 1 of each odd-numbered year. It requires 90% of the remaining funds be transferred to Oregon Health Authority Fund to be used for health care initiatives. It requires the final 10% be transferred to tobacco use reduction account. Applies to funds received on or after January 1st, 2014. It requires emergency effective on its passage.
And doesn't the amendment provide some funds for DOJ to...
Yes.
Yeah, and also DOJ needs funds to keep the thing on track, I guess. The purpose of this is to send it to Ways and Means. There's no assurance that that will happen, but Ways and Means Committee is interested in having it available to see how things shake down at the end. So can I have a motion on 2136?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment stated 4-10-13 to House Bill 2136.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2136. Is there any discussion on the Dash 1s? Any objection? You got your cord here. It is. The Dash 1 is added to 2136. Can I have a motion on the bill, please?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2136 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves House Bill 2136 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
You know, I struggle with bills like this because we're given a small back. Just a small piece of tobacco settlement dollars back to dealing with tobacco issues. And we're using the funds for all kinds of other programs and that we see fit. And to me, it should be used strictly for tobacco cessation programs, helping with lung cancer, things like that, and strictly for tobacco. And I'll probably support sending it to Ways and Means, but I hope they look at that very closely because, I mean, these funds are coming from people who use tobacco, so the money should be going back to tobacco users, is the way I see it.
I think yeah. Any other discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Whitener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
And Chair Greenman?
Aye. Motion carries and House Bill 2136 is on the way to Ways and Means. Are you ready for the toxics bill?
Sure.
Close the work session on House Bill 2136 and open a work session on House Bill 3162. Will you tell us what this bill is about? And after Representative Katie Geyer, will you tell where we are in it now?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3162 with the Dash 4 amendment requires the Oregon Health Authority to maintain a list of designated high-priority chemicals of concern for children's health used in children's products. The Postal List Authority's website defines malleable intentionally added chemical. It requires manufacturers of certain children's products provide notice to authority regarding intentionally added chemicals or chemicals at levels above 100 parts per million. It clarifies parameters, civil penalties, and limits phase-out requirements to malleable children's cosmetics and products marketed for use by children under 3 years of age. It clarifies parameter for waivers. Declares emergency effective on its passage.
Thank you. If Ruby ever gets tired, you can take over. Where are we with this, Representative Kenny Geyer?
I'll start, and I would love it if Representative Conger would fill in for me. There's a few amendments on this. the dash four includes a lot of the amendments and more that were in dash one, two, and three. Some of it is has to do with phase three, which is the phase out of harmful chemicals, and we have now restricted that to the ones that we're most concerned about, which is chemicals and products that are meant for children under three and chemicals and products that are mouthable or on the skin and hair. There's another change in violation, which allows companies who may have a violation, well, companies to have 90 days as opposed to 30 days before it's counted as a violation if they've applied for a waiver and haven't gotten... you're the one that's helping with that. So anyway, we're giving them more time before we consider it a violation. There are a number...
Time really to cure the violation. It gives them more time to fix it before they get fined.
So I'm going to hand it over to you because you've been really great on adding the details and making sure that we have strong parameters on this.
Yeah, I would say that the amendments fall into the category, universal category of trying to make the bill clearer so that those who are being regulated by it, those who have to provide the notice or potentially look for an alternative way to make their product eventually, as we phase out these high priority, high concern chemicals, it gives them more clarity about what their options are as they approach that timeline of 5 years from passage of the bill. Representative Kenny Guy already described most of the amendments. I think the other parts that are really relevant are that we have tied it to science that's being done at the federal level, so that if the federal government, which obviously has a significantly more resources to work on something as complicated as developing a real understanding of the harm from chemicals and levels of exposure that are safe, if the federal government establishes a safe exposure level for one of the chemicals that is on the list, we would still continue to collect notice because we'd still like to know that those chemicals are being used in children's products. But the section banning the use of the chemical would become inoperative with respect to that particular chemical. Effectively, it would come off the list for purposes of the ban, not for purposes of notice. I think that pretty much covers the basic points. The rest of the bill has largely stayed the same, meaning that the list is developed the same way as we discussed before. There's 19 chemicals that would be picked up right now. Those would be required. Manufacturers are using those products in children's toys and other products would be required to disclose it. They already are in the state of Washington, so the disclosure we think would be entirely just sharing what they already provide to the state of Washington. And then after 5 years, those chemicals would be phased out of use unless there was no alternative or unless there was evidence that the chemicals were safe at the level being used. There's a variety of ways manufacturers can show that.
One of the other amendments was also if a chemical comes off of DEQ's or Washington's list, then it would come off of ours as well.
Right.
So there were a lot of little technical tweaks to this.
Just trying to make it
I really
clearer
want to thank you for working with Oregon Environmental Council to really tighten this bill. I think it's a great piece of legislation.
Okay, are we ready? Yes.
There's been a lot of concern expressed about BPA and the food processing industry. How does that reflect in this bill?
Well, it's reflected in what he said about if something is regulated by the federal government, which BPA now is for children's products, then it would not fall under our legislation.
One, I guess, concern that has been raised about going to the clarity on this is in some of the as a manufacturer phases out use of a chemical, one of the ways that they can continue to make the product is to provide an alternative chemical that would accomplish the same thing that the original restricted chemical would. And as part of that process, we have asked that they provide what's called a hazard assessment. I had to learn what that was, but I would say it's somewhat of a term of art, but it's a little vague. So we left it to OHA to determine how that would that would work. I think it's vague enough that it creates some concern, and there may be some ways that we could tighten that. We may need to try to do that, to work with OHA after passage in the rulemaking process. I want to make it clear that from where I'm sitting, the standard needs to be clear. The cost needs to be kept down as low as we can, with the goal of getting the these hazardous chemicals, these toxic chemicals, out of children's products in the long run, or showing that they're not harmful. And if a manufacturer complies, I want to make it as clear about how they do it so that they can continue to provide the product. And I want to make it as smooth and seamless and certain as possible, rather than just prescriptive and difficult and costly with no benefit. And I think that that's the spirit that the bill is written in. It turns out it's very complicated when you get to this level of chemistry, science, and biological science, human biology. So I think it may need a little bit more work on the Senate side, but I think it's at a point where we should move it along.
Okay. Do I have a motion on the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 4 amendment dated 4/12/13 to House Bill 3162.
Representative Thompson moves we adopt the Dash 4 amendments dated 4/12/13 to House Bill 3162. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection? Dash 4s are included in 3162. Motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3162 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Thompson moves that we send the House Bill 3162 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means
by prior reference.
By prior reference. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Just kind of curious, because the federal government weighs in a lot on this type of stuff, and that's kind of what they do. Oregon's 3% of the market, and I'm just wondering if this is really something we should be weighing in on, because it just takes a department head to say the bottles that we're drinking out of aren't safe, and then what have we run into there? And I couldn't see where it exempts us out of, if the federal says it's safe, what's to stop the State Department head from saying, no, it's not safe? And who makes, I mean, I just worry we're heading down a slippery slope here, and I'll be voting no on the bill, and I think that's something we need to think about as we're moving forward with this, because I think we're going to hurt Oregonians from being able to get products, and we don't have any way to stop that from happening.
Yeah.
So the federal government actually does not take action. There's a great article in the New York Times that just came out yesterday that talks about how the federal agency that is in charge of this has not been able to keep up with at all. When there are new chemicals that come on the market, the federal government actually has a certain amount of time by which it can say whether it's safe or not, and it almost always lets that time go just because there are not enough resources to investigate this, which is why a lot of states are starting to take this into their own hands, particularly for their most vulnerable populations. We certainly hope that the federal government will start catching up and start doing this. It would be a lot easier if the federal government did it than state by state. And if that were to happen, and that's partly why the bill is written the way it is, if federal regulations come into place, that would supersede ours. Even if the federal regulation is a little less restrictive than ours, we've said if you're going to regulate at all, then we're going to let you do it. But if you're not, and if you're way behind on this, then we need to protect at least our most vulnerable populations. The idea is that it shouldn't restrict products at all, because it's only geared toward the ones that are under 3, the ones that actually go in your mouth, on your skin, and it's asking them to phase out. If they don't phase out, then, we assume that they will. Over a 5-year period, we assume that they will. And they have, you know, if there is, if they can show that there's nothing else on the market, or if they can show that there actually is no exposure, then they won't need to phase out. But if there's, if there are other things on the market, and if there is exposure, and these are the most harmful chemicals, then we strongly believe that they should be phased out.
Okay.
And if I may point you to the section in the amendment of Senator Widener, it's page 6, line, starting at line 21, and particularly the section 7B, what will be section 7B in the bill. It says, any consumer product safety standard adopted under federal law that establishes allowable levels for children's products of a high priority chemical of concern for children's health used in children's products is presumed to establish the maximum allowable level of the chemical that may be used in children's products that are offered, sold or offered for sale in the state, meaning that, and then it goes on to say the authority may not require a manufacturer in compliance with the federal standard to also comply with the provisions of this section. So the intent there was to capture the fact that the federal government should be and hopefully is in the process of looking at these chemicals and starting to develop the science that we probably don't have the resources to develop and to set those standards. And if the manufacturer is in compliance with the federal standard, then they would not be subject to that section of the Act, which is the ban on the chemical.
I just get a little nervous because with some of the chemicals, when they're saying formaldehyde and other things, well, that's a byproduct of wood. So I've done a lot of work at a lot of these resin plants in different facilities, and I know where a lot of these chemicals end up in soap, different things like that. And yet we had people saying how awful they were here. Well, we wouldn't have any of the products if we didn't have those chemicals.
So again, these are children's products.
Okay, we ready?
Please call the roll.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kammer?
No.
Representative Wigley?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Kitty Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenman?
Aye. Motion carries. House Bill 3162 is on its way to Ways and Means. Close the work session on House Bill 3162. Open a work session on House Bill 2279. Mr. Administrator, what do we got here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2279 allows the governing body of local government to elect to participate in a benefit plan offered by a public employees benefit board or Oregon Educators Benefit Board. It requires government to appoint 2 voting members to PAB or OAB for each local government which elects to participate in the plan offered by the board, and 2 additional members for each 25,000 eligible employees. It clarifies the decision to participate in benefit plans offered by PAB or OAB is made by the governing body, not subject to collective bargaining. It allows the governing body of local government to use the benefit plan offered by PAB or OAB to participate in the benefit plan offered by the Oregon Health Authority. That is in conformity with the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act and requires Director of OHA appoint Executive Director PAB, who shall report directly to the Director of OHA.
We have a dash one amendment.
Those are the provisions of the dash one amendment. That's the provisions of the dash one.
Apparently, the counties and cities have gone neutral on this. The point has been made that it's completely voluntary and doesn't force them into anything, but gives them the option of joining. Can I have a motion on the amendment, please?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated 4-11-13 to House Bill 2279.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves the Dash 1 amendment dated 4-11-13 to House Bill 2279. Is there any discussion on the amendments? Any objection? The amendments are in House Bill 2279. We have a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2279 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves House Bill 2279 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, as amended, with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means Is that by prior reference or is that new?
By prior reference.
Is there any discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I will be a no on this. There's just too many of our school districts that are wanting to opt out of OWEB. I think we may have made a mistake with the bill we let out of here the other day. And I see OWEB doing more to drive the cost of health care up rather than reducing the cost of health care. And I'd just as soon not have our cities coming and crying to us just like our school districts are to be able to opt out. So I will not be supporting this bill today.
Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair, I just say I'm probably going to vote no on this as well. I don't remember there being a real need that we're addressing. That may be my memory lapsing, but I'm not sure that there's a...
It gets worse.
it's a frightening thought, given where I'm at right now. I didn't remember an urgent burning need for this, and I also could not remember the methodology to opt out subsequently once a entity of government had opted in, and so under the circumstances, I think I'll be a tepid no.
I will be a solid no, Mr. Chair, not even tepid.
Okay, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Klim?
Aye.
Representative Congress?
No.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnaman?
No.
Representative Whiteley?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Kenny Guyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Greenman?
Aye. Motion carries, and House Bill 2279 is on its way to Ways and Means. Close the work session on House Bill 2279 and open a public hearing, I hope a brief public hearing, on House Bill 2037. What's this bill about, Mr. Administrator, and who have we got waiting? Mark Sansusi is waiting. You might join us while we're hearing what the bill is about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2037A instructs health professional regulatory boards to license spouse or domestic partner of active members of the armed forces. Requires qualifying spouse or domestic partner show competency in 1 year teaching or providing services in the past 3. Allows health professional regulatory boards to issue temporary licenses to applicant military spouse or domestic partners under certain circumstances. It directs teacher standards and practices commission to establish rule expediting Oregon's licensing process for military spouse or domestic partners of active members of the armed forces. It requires military spouse or domestic partners to be licensed to teach in another state and subject to military transfer to Oregon. It declares an emergency effective on its passage.
Mrs. Sansusi.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Committee. Thank you for hearing this bill. My name is Mark Sansusi, and I'm the Department of Defense Regional Liaison for the Northwest, including Oregon, here to express the Department of Defense's support for this bill to help military spouses with license portability when they move into the state of Oregon from other places. I've posted, there are 3 or 4 testimonies I've done previously posted, so I'll just extrapolate some facts from previous ones rather than read testimony to you. The military spouse issue was the number 2 issue of the Department of Defense. Has support from the Joining Forces Initiative of Michelle Obama, Joe Biden. 95% of military spouses are women, and it's a family decision when people decide to stay in, re-enlist and stay in the military, and to keep that second career going is really important to us. Military spouses tend to move almost 14 times more than our civilian spouses, moving active duty ones at least every 3 years or so. In Oregon specifically, we know that you have 933 active duty spouses and thousands of 5,300 reserves, but this is primarily for those active duty spouses that are transiting and working in your state. So we know that you have 933, around 53% of them are employed. Around a third of them have licenses. And so when you just do the math, there's 317 roundabout that would be affected if they move annually. You can divide that by 3, so it's around 120 of different occupations and careers. A Department of Defense, Department of Treasury study showed that the number 1 profession in the top 20 for military spouses is teachers, and you've addressed that nicely in this bill. And registered nurses is the number three occupation in this legislation. At this point, there are 28 states that have enacted policies similar to what you're considering. Just recently, Idaho, one of my other states, did this just last week. Well, we have 13 other states working on similar legislation this session. And in closing, grateful for your help on this. I stand for any questions, and thank you for last year. Our number one goal last year was passing the Veterans Academic and Service Member Occupational License Credit issue, and you did that, so thank you very much. And I stand for any questions.
Thank you. Is there any opposition? Have you heard from any of the boards or anybody that
Mr. Chair, worried about this? Mr. Chair, the one amendment where nurses had wanted to add an and versus an or, which was, and I've heard about no other opposition.
So we have an amendment? Oh, is it already?
It's the 2037A.
Already done. Yes. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2037A and open a work session on House Bill 2037A.
Chair?
Yes, sir.
This deals with teaching. I'm just wondering, why is it in health care?
Well, because I think most of them are probably health licensees as well.
So, well, it's also dealing with teachers, though, too, if I'm looking at this correctly, and nurses.
And any...
So I feel comfortable on the nursing side.
You want to comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, I kind of asked the same question. I was just told the leadership made a decision that that's where it was headed, so I have nothing to do with that. I'm just here to support. So.
But what proportion do you, from your experience, are these are going to be healthcare workers as opposed to?
Well, 3.7% are registered nurses. 5.2% are teachers on that top 20 occupation from that study from last year. So they tend to be single-digit occupations.
I think it's because the nurses stand to gain employment here, whereas the teachers not so much.
I'm not sure that's
that would
either.
Be true right now.
True right now. Mm-hmm.
Now, okay. Because my next question is, I was thinking that maybe they thought we were more ignorant and would move this bill for them.
That's possible.
Than the Education Committee.
Should, can you call the roll, please? Oh, I need a motion. Wait a minute.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2037A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Thompson moves House Bill 2037A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Can you please call the roll?
Representative Klein?
Absent.
Representative Parker. Aye. Representative Whitley. Aye. Representative Widener. Aye. Vice Chair Kenny Geyer. Aye. Vice Chair Thompson. Aye. Chair Beamer.
Try Clem again first.
Representative Clem. Aye. <laughs> And I'm an aye as well. The motion passes. Volunteer
to carry this.
I'll carry it, Mr. Chair.
Senator Widener.
The chance to find out about teachers.
Should you promise not to make snide remarks about this committee? Have at it.
I was elevating the education committee.
Good catch, Mr. Chair.
Okay. I will close the work session on House Bill 2037A and open up a work session on House Bill 3407. Mr. Administrator, will you tell us what we have here?
Yeah, you can. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3407 establishes Traditional Health Workers Commission within Oregon Health Authority, requires Director of OHA appoint members of the commission, requires the commission to adopt by rule criteria and education requirements supporting care organizations with respect to health care workers not licensed by the state.
And you commenting on the dash fives as well?
The dash five amendment replaces references to community workers with traditional, requires the director ensure board represents geographic, ethnic, gender, racial, disability status, gender identity, sexual orientation, economic diversity of traditional health workers, requires OHA adopt by rule criteria and education requirements, appropriate professional designations, process for approval, classifications, coordinating care positions used with respect to traditional health workers.
Representative Kenny Geyer, do you want to talk to us about where you think this is now?
Yeah, so just as a reminder for you all, since our last hearing,
This sets up formally a commission of health professionals who are not licensed at this point. It includes community health care workers, peer wellness specialists, personal health navigators, and doulas. And this is something that we, as a in our health transformation, really want to build up in our workforce and rely on more and more. And there has been an informal task force or work group working with Oregon Health Authority to kind of define what their roles and responsibilities are, how CCOs would use them, what supervisory relationships would look at, and educational requirements, qualifications. So this formalizes it. It lays out that scope of work by the commission. The amendments have to do with making, there's been some confusion because it was community health care workers, but that's only one profession within several. So it's called the traditional, anywhere where it said community health workers, because we want to refer to all those different jobs, it replaces it with traditional. One of the probably more meaningful changes is that this commission originally, in the original bill, was set up to have rulemaking authority. And in this amendment, we're switching that back to Oregon Health Authority because normally commissions don't have their own rulemaking authority in terms of final authority, and perhaps particularly a new one wouldn't usually have that. So after a lot of discussion between Oregon Health Authority and the commission, we decided to put the rulemaking authority back at Oregon Health Authority. So I'd say that's the main gist of this amendment.
Okay. Do we have a motion on the amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 5 amendment stated 4-12-13 to House Bill 3407.
Representative Kenny Geyer moves the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 3407 dated 4-12-13. Is any discussion on the amendments? How about the bill now?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3407 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. And I will just note that there's a minimal or no fiscal on it, but that's normally what happens when you have commissions, set up new commissions.
Right, exactly. Representative Kenny Geyer moves House Bill 3407 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
I'm talkative today. So I'm supportive of keeping the people that have been involved in the system as I'm signed on to this bill and everything, but I think it's something Ways and Means needs to look at closely, as I have two parents that are dealing with healthcare professionals that are showing up, both my father-in-law and my stepfather and my grandmother, and these people are showing up and leaving large bills, $900 to come check their blood pressure. They show up and ask them if they can, you know, make it to the bathroom on their own, and they're telling them not to come back, or physical therapists showing up saying we don't need the help, yet they keep showing up and charging them for these visits. And there's a lot of money that's being spent in the system. And I think the navigators and some of these wellness specialists might be a drain on the healthcare system. So I'm hoping Ways and Means looks at this very closely, because this is something I'm dealing with personally with family members at this point. And this may not be the right direction for us to go, but if we're going to go with it, there should be people that have been involved in the system and that have already been working the system. So I'll support it out here, but I want Ways and Means to look at it for those reasons.
Absolutely. Any other discussion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Klim?
Aye.
Representative Conker?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Wiley?
Aye.
Representative Whitener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
And Chair Greenlee?
Aye. Motion carries. 3407 is on its way to Ways and Means, which are most of the other bills we're working on, it looks like. And I will close the work session on House Bill 3407 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2085. Does anybody here want to testify on House Bill 2085? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2085. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2445. Mr. Administrator, tell me what we've got.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2445 with the Dash 6 Amendment requires Oregon Health Authority adopt by rule certification procedures and criteria for school-based health centers. It requires OHA convene work groups to recommend best practices. Authorizes OHA to contract with an entity that coordinates school-based health center care. It defines school-based health centers as health clinic on school grounds providing primary preventative behavioral and oral health care and educational services through licensed or certified health professionals or students enrolled in professional medical, nursing, or dental programs. Requires Oregon Health Authority provide stable, consistent, predictable funding for school-based health centers. Requires the Health Authority create a pool of funds to increase the number of school-based health centers which act as patient-centered primary care facilities without requiring certification and improve delivery and coordination of care. Requires Health Authority convene work group to develop recommendations for effective and coordinated use of school-based health centers for children who qualify for medical assistance. Requires the Health Authority report on progress to the interim committee on or before December 31st, 2013. It sunsets the work group on January 2nd, 2014.
We have the dash sixes. Do we have a motion on the dash sixes?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 6 Amendment dated 4-9-13 to House Bill 2445.
Representative Thompson moves the Dash 6 Amendments be added to House Bill 2445. They're dated 4-9-13. Is there any discussion of the amendments? Any objection? So moved. Can we have a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2445 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior
reference. Is there any discussion? Representative Thompson moves House Bill 2445 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Yes. Mr. Chair, again, another one that I'm personally involved with because we have one of these at our school, and I'm concerned with the school-based health centers because they're treating kids and parents aren't knowing some of the things that are going on when they go see the school-based health center. They're not contacting parents, letting them know what they're finding. My son had a physical at one, and he had some problems. They didn't see any of it. The problems that he had, and we had to go to a regular doctor. We knew some of the issues. So I think we need to do a lot of work and make sure there's parental notification that's not going on right now every time they see a child, because that's not being done at them. So I will not be supporting this bill.
Thank you, Representative Widener. Is there any other discussion on this? Debbie, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Klim?
Aye.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Harker?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Aye.
Chair Green?
Aye. House Bill 2445 has passed and is on its way. This is on its way to the floor, is that right?
Ways and Means.
Okay. That's right. We had insurance on its way to Ways and Means. Close the work session on 2445. We have nine bills to carry over, nine work sessions, and we have, how many bills do we have on the agenda besides Friday? Is it one more or two more? Two more on the agenda. So we're going to have a busy day Wednesday. Please come on time. If there are amendments and other issues, try and read them, and we can talk about them in advance. And here are the bills I'm carrying over to Wednesday for a work session. House Bill 2118, House Bill 2132, House Bill 2122, House Bill 3403, House Bill 2928, House Bill 3345, House Bill 3082, House Bill 2085, and House Bill 2960. I'm not carrying over House Bill 2088. That is not being carried over. Is there any other? Let's try and be here on time. Plan on holding 5 o'clock. Not that I don't think we can get the bills done, but if we run into a glitch and need something, another amendment or another fiscal, we'll be able to carry it over till 5 o'clock and deal with that bill as well.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
2960, did you say you're carrying that one over?
I'm carrying that over.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you all for your attention. We're adjourned.
So Wednesday's the day.